I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Patrick Collison, co-founder of Stripe, a financial software company that helps businesses manage their online and mobile transactions. Stripe handles billions of dollars of transactions every year, helping businesses and nonprofits accept payments and donations from customers worldwide. These businesses range from Adidas to Best Buy, Facebook, Warby Parker, Lyft, Twitter, Kickstarter, and nonprofits like NPR. Patrick started Stripe in 2009 when he was 21 years old with his younger brother, John. He is originally from Dromineer, Ireland, which has a population of roughly 70 people. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you were 21 when you launched Stripe. What took so long?
It actually took us a little bit longer to launch Stripe. I was 21 when we started working on it full time. As it happens, John and I, we'd spend quite a while, you know, working on various projects together. But for us, this was after, you know, many years of hacking on all sorts of sort of side projects and, you know, various pursuits, most of which didn't go anywhere, to be clear.
If you're somebody listening and financial software seems a bit esoteric, what are some examples of problems or uses for Stripe? So let's say, for instance, I make clothes and I want to sell them online. How can Stripe help me?
Well, I think you're right that when you talk about sort of financial software or something like that, it sort of immediately has this kind of veneer of being somewhat arcane, and you wonder, well, what exactly are you doing? But for us, you know, it was a very concrete, tangible, and sort of personal issue that you know, we had faced many times. It's just the basic matter of, I've built something online. I've created a website. I have a mobile app. There's some service I want to offer. And I just want to get money from my customers. And so you need something to go from, again, having a website to sort of to actually being an internet business. And the thing that was so surprising to us was that kind of making that transition was sort of previously so difficult. In that, you know, in 2009, 2010, hosting was becoming much more straightforward. And there were all these, you know, quite effective companies that made it much easier to build a website. And then you go and you try to handle, you know, the financial aspect of it, just some way to charge your customers. And then you had to go talk to all these, you know, traditional banks, and they didn't quite understand the internet, and you'd have to go fill out all this paperwork, and, you know, it sort of felt like a mortgage application. John and I were kind of searching for the kind of technology-enabled version of this, the version you go to a website, you sign up for it, and you can start charging your customers. We kind of assumed that this naturally, that this must exist. And it was only after kind of several weeks of hunting for this company that we kind of came to realize that maybe it didn't.
It's been said that Jack Dorsey launched Square to help make payments easier in the physical world, just as Stripe is helping to make payments easier in the virtual world. And when Stripe came out, I thought, oh, Stripe, the name sounds so similar to Square. But the name of the company wasn't originally Stripe. Can you tell me what
That's
the original
right.
name was?
The original name for the company was Dev Payments. And actually, the way we kind of wrote that was with these slash characters. And so it was /dev/payments. Mm-hmm. And that was actually sort of a reference to this kind of obscure part of Unix, the operating system. And so as developers, we thought there was a kind of clever name. But as you might imagine, the rest of the world wasn't sort of necessarily so enamored. And, you know, we'd go have this meeting with some fancy bank or something like that. And, you know, we might feel like we're making some progress. And then at the end of the meeting, they would ask what our name was. And we'd sort of tell them. And you could sort of see their enthusiasm dim, not insubstantially. And so after a lot of this experience, we decided that it might behoove us to find something a bit better.
Stripe, the domain name, was owned by, coincidentally, an MIT alum.
That's right. We eventually found that Stripe.com was owned by, as you say, I'm not sure if I can say a fellow MIT alum, being a mere dropout, but someone who'd had a little bit more academic success at MIT than I had, and I think he took some pity on us. and was willing to part with the name. And you know, the funny thing is, we actually weren't sure at the time if Stripe was a better name. But we decided that if we couldn't come up with a better name by December 20th, I think it was December 20th, 2010, we would just default to Stripe. And so we defaulted.
I want to understand how you stumbled here. It seems like an unlikely company to be starting, having grown up in rural Ireland. And I want to talk a bit about your upbringing. Your parents, Lily and Dennis. Lily was a microbiologist who started her own company. Can you give me some background on that?
Sure. So, as you say, she went to school to train as a microbiologist, and she worked at Abbott, the pharmaceutical company. And then when I was born, I think she decided that she was going to go care for me full time. And then after a couple of weeks, realized that I wasn't all that interesting or engaging, and so needed to figure out something better to do with her time. And so she started this corporate training company called SQT.
Now, you say she decided to raise you, but wasn't there a little nudge by her company to raise you? Wasn't there a letter that her employer gave her?
That's right. Certainly back in 1988, Ireland, it was still a quite Catholic place. And there was certainly a very strong expectation that she would go and become a full-time mother at home. There was a letter from her employer of the time congratulating her on the birth of her son, again, as a full-time mother. And I think she took some umbrage at that.
You mean before she had told the company that she was going to do that?
Right.
Dennis, your father is an electrical engineer. Did he start or buy a hotel to run?
That's right. So I was born in Limerick in Ireland and lived there for the first couple of years of my life. And then when I was 5 or 6, Dad decided to buy this very tiny hotel by the shores of Lough Derg in Ireland, in the village of Drumnir. And the hotel, I think at the time, had 12 bedrooms or thereabouts. And that's where I spent most of my childhood.
What were some defining features of your childhood? I mean, here you are, you're heavy into technology now. It doesn't seem like technology was a likely part of that.
Drumnir isn't quite Silicon Valley.
Right. So what were dominant features of your childhood?
It maybe goes without saying, but it was very rural. Our house was surrounded by farms. And so my friends were broadly dispersed, and really none of them were within walking distance. It would always require sort of parental transportation. And so the sort of the main characteristic is some degree of isolation. And, you know, that sounds, I guess, quite negative. And I really don't mean it that way at all. And maybe a sort of another framing of it would be having to sort of construct our own worlds and sort of figure out our own pursuits. But I really remember kind of coming home from school every day and spending a huge amount of my time reading. The sort of standard routine was to go from school to the library, get 2 books from the library, go home, read the 2 books, and then repeat the next day. We had the time and the space to do that. I have very fond memories of it. And then, you know, once I turned, I believe around 12 or 13, maybe 14, we finally got a proper satellite internet connection. And the satellite aspect was kind of salient because the phone line that ran to our house was of such poor quality that it could barely support the internet.
What was most striking to you about the internet? What was so magnetic for you about that world that you wanted to be a part of it?
You know, I found computers magnetic even before the internet. We got our first computer when I was, I guess, about 8. It just the whole thing seemed so magical. This striking device capable of all of these things despite its, you know, diminutive size. Certainly at that age, I wasn't really able to sort of fit all the pieces together and to understand how, you know, electrons moving in wires added up to kind of pixels on screens. But I did know that I really wanted to understand it. Computers themselves, they really seemed the most magical thing to me that I'd stumbled across.
When you were 16 years old, you won a science award. It was the 41st Young Scientist of the Year award in Ireland. And you helped to create a new version of an artificial intelligence computer language called Lisp. Was that the first time that you got this national recognition? What did that do for you?
this science contest was something that had been kind of on my radar for some number of years. It's run annually after Christmas, and my parents had brought me to it fairly frequently during my childhood. I really found the exhibition and the sort of carnival of science that it was to be really cool. The first thing I ever entered with was a fairly direct artificial intelligence programming project where I was trying to build what's currently known as a bot. And so I guess I was 15 years too soon. It was a bot that talked to lots of people over sort of instant messaging and tried to learn from those conversations. That bot won second place overall. I wanted to enter again the next year. And so sort of worked on something slightly different, which was a new kind of web framework, but written, as you say, in this kind of artificial intelligence programming language called Lisp. That was the project that ended up winning.
Now, what were, this might seem non sequitur, what were some odd jobs you had while you were living in rural Ireland?
I worked on creating a website for the school I first went to. And then my uncle owned a pub in Dromineer, and he used to have a hard time synchronizing all of the cash registers in the pub. And so I think that may actually have been the first job I was ever paid for. I think I helped him program his cash registers, and then he gave me €20.
You started your first company when you were still in your teens. It was called Octomatic. You were at MIT, and it was basically a company whose ambition was to compete with eBay. You worked on that with your brother or on your own?
With my brother. I'd started college a year early, and so John and I decided to just go work on some kind of software project / company together. And that sort of became Octomatic.
This was not your first time in the United States. You had come once before to Stanford. What were your impressions of Stanford or of the United States?
It was really a striking trip. I suppose it was the first time I'd ever met a community of people interested in programming. And then, of course, Stanford itself is so implausibly pristine and sort of on another plane to anything I'd ever encountered before. And before that trip, I'd never considered going to school outside of Ireland. But after having seen Stanford, it seemed like I had to at least try.
Did you apply to Stanford?
I did. I applied to four U.S. schools, of which Stanford was one. The one I really wanted to go to was MIT, because MIT was the school that still took Lisp, this programming language, really seriously. And so I was very crestfallen when I got to MIT in 2006. And that first fall semester, you know, they had this famous class, 6001, that taught Lisp to kind of incoming freshmen. And that they announced the cancellation of it that semester that I started.
What a typical freshman woe.
I'm glad you share my pain.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Patrick Collison, co-founder of Stripe. We'll hear more from Patrick coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Patrick Collison, co-founder of Stripe, a financial service software platform that powers e-commerce features for more than 100,000 businesses and nonprofits globally in countries ranging from Japan to Cuba, Mexico, and Australia. Patrick was born in 1988 in Ireland. So you're at MIT. You built Octomatic. It was sold for $5 million to Live Current Media with the help of Y Combinator. That was sort of like the incubator that you were accepted to that gave you your first $20,000 or $30,000 or so. And then here you were embarking on your next project. What were some apps you flirted with starting or companies you flirted with starting before you came to Stripe?
The big thing that John and I were sort of interested in parallel at the time was the iPhone and the sort of new possibilities afforded by it. And we'd actually worked together on these apps that stored a copy of Wikipedia on the iPhone so you could read it without having internet access. And so when you're traveling or when you were on, you know, the proverbial mountaintop or something like that, you still had access to sort of the sum total of human knowledge in your hands. And then when the App Store came out, we sort of made these apps available for sale, and, you know, it didn't make a whole lot of revenue, but it was enough to be, you know, quite meaningful for us as college students. And so we were interested in that and that direction in Wikipedia and sort of collaborative, you know, information curation, cultivation, generation. But we were also kind of interested in the fact that these apps were the first things we'd ever built that we had charged for. Mm. And we kind of thought that was sort of striking in some way, and that why had we never charged for anything else? And we realized it was because the App Store made it so straightforward and so easy. When you thought about that, that seemed like a sort of a deep fact that here we had this business and we were investing in it and we were creating things for it and we were kind of really taking it seriously in a way that wouldn't have happened had it been difficult to charge. It had kind of really changed our trajectory. Mm-hmm. And so then as we thought about that kind of more broadly outside of the App Store with regard to, you know, the internet as a whole, the fact that it seemed so difficult to build a business seemed like it might not just cause some unnecessary pain, but it might actually change the number of and the kinds of businesses that get started. It might have this kind of chilling effect on people's, you know, willingness and ability to kind of to get off the ground and to sort of get that nascent thing started. And so these other apps that we were building sort of in parallel to Stripe, they were actually quite influential in causing us to pursue Stripe itself.
Now, you did what all programmers do to start this idea or to build this prototype. You went on vacation to Argentina. Argentina is a hacker's paradise, interestingly enough. Why is that?
So it was January in Boston, and we decided we should go somewhere else to work for the month and decided we should look for some place with good weather, which probably meant the Southern Hemisphere, that was, you know, affordable on student budgets. And where things were open late into the night so that you could sort of work a programmer's schedule and still be able to find dinner. It seemed like Buenos Aires, from everything we had read, really fit these criteria. And we were actually influenced by the writings of a guy whose name I'll probably mispronounce, Maciej Sadlovsky. But he has this wonderful blog and sort of travelogue at idlewords.com. And it's still going. He was very recently in Antarctica, but he had written in kind of effusive terms about the experience of working in and being in Buenos Aires. And so off we went. And the reason I mention Maciej is because he is in fact now a Stripe user. And so the whole thing comes full circle.
Now, here you were, you and your brother, building this financial service prototype. What did that look like in its most nascent or skeletal form?
It was a website where you could fill out some basic information about your business, and then an incredibly straightforward and sort of simple API for charging credit cards and eventually having the money appear in your bank account.
There was no link yet to any financial institution. You were just building kind of the front end, right?
That's roughly right. We actually knew somebody who worked at another payments company, and he agreed to sort of help us kind of wire these up together for the beta and to sort of test some of the initial transactions out. And so it wasn't properly integrated into any financial backend, but it sort of, it was sort of held together enough that you could kind of squint and get a sense for what the experience might be.
What did some of these sort of, glue and tape versions look like? What were some of those earliest transactions and with whom?
We gave access to some of our friends, and because we'd been through Y Combinator before with Octomatic, we had some friends who themselves were running companies or were entrepreneurs. Really, we pestered them until they integrated, and I think out of some degree of obligation, they finally relented. And so Stripe's first user was a company called 280 North. But the interesting thing that then happened was once a couple of people had integrated, and it really was a bit of a pain to convince the first couple of people to do so, just because it's never quite the top of mind thing. But they then told their friends that if you wanted to do anything involving internet payments, you should go talk to the Stripe guys. And we started to now assemble this list of people who basically wanted access. And we couldn't support all of them because we hadn't built everything we needed to build. But as we sort of went back to school after this trip to Buenos Aires, we had this sort of ever-growing document full of email addresses of mm-hmm. people we were supposed to invite. And so we spent the summer as sort of this bootstrapped internship working on inviting all of these people. And that's really how we started working on Stripe full time.
Now, were your parents, for instance, when they heard that you were leaving MIT or taking a leave of absence and your brother was taking a leave of absence from Harvard, were they like, that's fine because they know how self-starting you guys are? Or was it heavier than that?
They were always surprisingly supportive. In hindsight, I sort of appreciate that more than I think I did at the time. I think I was probably more a sort of an entitled teenager who took it all for granted. But whether it was sort of going to this conference in the US when I was 15 or 16 by myself, or whether it was trying to go to college in the US and pursuing all these different paths, they were always surprisingly okay with it, such that when we decided to go work on Stripe full-time, to some degree, I think they were used to things like that. And this was certainly not the first kind of weird thing we had tried to pursue. I think when John went to college, they gave him some stern words about how they wanted him to graduate and not to be sort of seduced by some entrepreneurial pursuit along the way, but it wasn't quite effective enough.
You mentioned that word of mouth played a part in, getting the service or getting Stripe known to other people or companies. Were there one or two companies that came to you that you're like, whoa, this is legit. These are not just my friends. Were there any specific larger companies or enterprises that made you take note?
Not long after we launched. Now, this is obviously skipping forward some period of time. But when we launched in September 2011, we were still very small and had a couple dozen customers. And not long after that, a subdivision of Walmart started integrating with Stripe. And this came completely out of the blue from our perspective. And when we talked to these Walmart guys, they told us that, they weren't using Stripe out of developer affinity or because they were our friends. We didn't know them. They were using it because it was better technology and because it was better than what they had access to internally. We had a sense that that might happen, but we sort of didn't really know how long it would take or sort of how far we were sort of along that trajectory. It really made us take the opportunity substantially more seriously.
Now, in addition to starting to get traction from customers, you were raising capital, and in the venture capital community, you also were getting traction and becoming credible. You did raise your first money from Y Combinator. They gave you, $20,000 to $30,000 or so to start?
I think it was a little bit less. I don't exactly recall the amount, but I think it was $15,000.
And then Peter Thiel, the founder of PayPal, you met him at a dinner, and he became an investor. Can you tell us about that?
We went and had lunch with Peter and described to him why, where we thought PayPal had erred. They had sort of built this person-to-person, this peer-to-peer payments product, which actually isn't the most interesting or important problem to solve. The most interesting and important problem to solve is how you enable new technology companies, how you enable new businesses to get started, and how you sort of help those scale to address the whole internet and enable people in far-flung geographies to go and to pursue new technological ideas. And so we kind of pitched him on all of this and told him how we thought PayPal was all wrong. And to my great surprise, he then essentially immediately agreed to invest. And I think people sometimes forget that even before he started PayPal, Peter wrote about how sort of important economic infrastructure was for the internet and some of the properties it ought to have and so forth. And so I think for Peter, he actually cares about the problem being solved more than he cares that PayPal specifically is the entity to do it. And I think that's kind of to his great credit. Same day, that afternoon, he agreed to invest.
You said you had lunch with him. How did you connect with him initially?
I believe we were introduced by Paul Graham.
Paul Graham being Y Combinator?
The founder of Y Combinator.
You have Andreessen Horowitz and Sequoia and Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla and SpaceX. They're investors. How many investors did you need to speak to before you got your handful of investors?
We spoke to a couple of investors before Peter invested. other investors we spoke with thought that this was clearly a somewhat ludicrous idea. And I mean, structurally speaking, it sort of was, right? We were going to build financial infrastructure despite no expertise in the area. We had no plans for how to deploy a significant marketing budget. We were just going to go sort of pursue developers directly and sort of build specifically for them. And this was sort of before developer technology had really become remotely popular. And that we were going to sort of try to solve all these hard problems, like how you sort of get past some of the geographical limitations of the internet and how you support new business models and things like that. And so we got a, you know, not an enormous number, but a non-trivial number of no's. And it really wasn't until Peter invested that people started to take us seriously. And then subsequent to that, things became substantially easier.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Patrick Collison, co-founder of Stripe, a financial service software platform that powers e-commerce features for more than 100,000 businesses and nonprofits globally. What was harder for you than you thought? The thought of starting something in the business in the financial service sector is inherently challenging, right, with regulatory hurdles and talking to banks, negotiating with banks, starting merchant accounts, partnering with credit card companies, making sure everything is secure.
There were lots of things that were hard that we expected to be hard. We knew that talking to banks would be complicated and that we'd have to sort of learn a whole lot about this new domain. I think the things that were harder than I expected were hiring people took much longer than I thought. I expected it to be hard. I didn't realize it would take so long. And especially when you're sort of, when you first try to identify the people you want to hire and then try to convince them to join, rather than going the other way of just looking at the people who want to join and sort of filtering down to the good ones. There are many people who now work at Stripe who took us years to convince to join.
You gave, gave up 10% of your equity for the first 10 people you hired. I mean, so it was very important to you initially to get those people.
You're right. There's a piece of advice we got pretty early on. It was actually from Sam Altman that nobody ever was glad they gave investors as much as they did. And no one ever wished that they had given employees less. You know, people always kind of wish that investors had less and that employees had more. And so I remember just that comment really sticking with me. And so in every negotiation with investors, we really tried to be sort of quite aggressive in terms of minimizing dilution. But in every conversation with an employee or with kind of employees in aggregate, we tried to bias towards more ownership.
You've had partnerships with Apple Pay and Visa and Twitter that further helped to put you on the map long after your Walmart beginnings. Which one of those was early enough to further legitimize, wow, we are on our way?
I think our partnership with Alipay was actually very significant from our standpoint because, you know, the whole sort of trajectory of Stripe came from this isolated upbringing and being in Ireland and coming to appreciate sort of how significant the internet was in sort of creating new kinds of opportunities and new kinds of connections and affording possibilities to people that really had not previously existed. And so with Stripe, we've always had this really strong sense that it's critical to make what we build universally available across the world in a way that really had not happened before.
And Alipay being a Chinese company.
Exactly. Back in 2014, when we partnered with Alipay, back then Alibaba had not IPO'd, and so the whole company was a little bit less well-known than it is now. But it's the most successful payment mechanism online in China. And it seemed so crazy to us that consumers, ordinary people in China, it was so difficult for them to transact with businesses outside of China in the US or in Western Europe or in any other part of the world. And it just seemed like such a bug in the internet, such as a failure of us as infrastructure creators. For us, this was really key and sort of exactly the kind of thing that we wanted to invest in, we wanted to enable, and we're still continuing to focus on and to work on, because this notion of building geographically universal economic infrastructure for the internet, it's still quite significantly incomplete.
You work with your brother in all of this, in John. He focuses on partnerships and sales, and you're more the engineering, the public face of the company. What is that dynamic? Have you always been close or not?
We've always been pretty close. I mean, as I guess, some degree of necessity to this, you know, point of having grown up in such a rural place. But if you'd asked me when I was 13 or 14, would I expect to be working with my brother in you know, 10 years hence. First, I'd have told you that I'd never contemplated it, and then probably secondly that I doubted it. But now that I sort of reflect back a little bit more, I think it's incredibly helpful to have sort of a co-founder dynamic sort of built on a very firm foundation and just a relationship that's endured for a long time. Most co-founder sets and relationships, even the successful companies, it seems they tend to break apart. And so I think the fact that John and I simply knew each other so well and had sort of so much experience with each other enabled us to be sort of very honest and direct and sort of straightforward in a way that I think was kind of conducive to Stripe's long-term stability.
You mentioned that reading was a big part of your upbringing. What are some books that you recall? Or even was there music in the picture?
I played some violin out of more obligation than any affinity for the instrument. But reading, I always loved. I clearly remember reading my first book and haven't really stopped since. And
what
so
was that?
The violin fell by the wayside. The first book was Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss. And the first book with maybe somewhat more prose and words. It was an Enid Blyton book. She's a very famous author among folks in the UK and Ireland, certainly, and has written hundreds of books for children. And so it was one of the Famous Five series.
Now, when we were first starting this interview, I mentioned I want to thank my nanny, Jill, for the idea to interview you in the first place, because she's from your hometown. She's from Limerick, Ireland, and her family went to high school with you and your brother. Her fiancé, Dan, his family owns Griffin's Funeral Home in Ireland, which you're aware of?
I certainly am. It's a very small world. I'm used to in Ireland coming across these sort of shared acquaintances and so on, and the country is only 4 million people. But it tends to happen less frequently here in San Francisco and in the U.S. And so this feels like a very Irish experience right now.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Patrick Collison, co-founder of Stripe. Coming up, we'll meet Philip Krim, co-founder of Casper. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.